From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, banned for life. The NBA delivers its verdict on the LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling following his alleged racist remarks.
Effective immediately, I am banning Mr. Sterling for life from any association with the Clippers organization or the NBA.
Also today, why an Olympic spokesman has described Rio's 2016 preparations as the worst in history, and the US Supreme Court hears whether police can search your cell phone without a warrant during arrest.
Somebody's expectation of privacy is reduced upon arrest, but it's not extinguished. It's a question, as the Fourth Amendment says, of what is reasonable.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says the Ukrainian crisis is a wake-up call, saying that NATO must show there are clear consequences for those who seek to upset international relations. He says Moscow has ignored the agreement brokered in Geneva to de-escalate the situation in Ukraine, and claims Russian President Vladimir Putin seeks to change the security landscape in Europe.
We have to make it absolutely clear to the Kremlin that NATO territory is inviolable. We will defend every single piece of it.
Mr. Kerry's comments came the day after the U.S. announced further sanctions on a number of Russians, including asset freezes and the denial of U.S. visas. Meanwhile, a crowd of pro-Russian separatists stormed the regional administration headquarters in the town of Luhansk in eastern Ukraine. Led by dozens of youths with metal bars, the crowd smashed windows, broke through the main doors, and then flew a Russian flag over the building. From Moscow, Anya Ardaeva reports.
Videos and photos showed men with shields, helmets, clubs, chains and other weapons smashing windows and pushing open the front doors of the regional administration building in Luhansk. Riot police guarding the administration were allowed to leave the building and there were no reports of violence. The activists then waved the Russian flag and the flag of the self-proclaimed Donetsk Republic from the roof and windows. The Ukrainian government says the pro-Russian separatists also plan to seize the local television center. In the past few weeks, government buildings all over eastern Ukraine have been seized by pro-Russia separatists, who Kyiv and Western governments say are supported by Moscow, a claim which the Russian government denies.
Severe weather is threatening as many as 73 million Americans after 2 days of powerful storms reportedly killed at least 31 people. The large storm system is making its way through the south after pummeling the central U.S. Kate Fisher reports.
A massive cleanup and recovery effort is underway in the tornado-ravaged southeast. The storms flattened buildings, overturned cars, and left thousands without power as twisters tore through parts of Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, and Tennessee. Witnesses say it sounded like a train roaring down the tracks.
Felt was like wind just blowing in glass and just stuff. Like whenever I got out, glass started cutting my leg.
And like all you seen was lightning, and the next one was like a big old explosion just hit the house.
And it's not over yet. Government forecasters have warned of more severe thunderstorms from the Gulf of Mexico up to the Great Lakes.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The vice president of the International Olympic Committee says the preparation for the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio, Brazil are the worst he's ever seen. John Coates said the situation is critical, but said there is no plan B. No matter what, the Olympics are headed to Rio. Brazil is also racing to ready itself for the 2014 FIFA World Cup, which begins in June. The preparations have left workers dead and caused protests in the streets. A group of top lawyers and academics have urged the United Nations to deliver aid to Syria without waiting on the consent of the Assad regime. The note signed by 35 legal experts call on the UN to ignore arbitrary government restrictions hampering aid from entering the country. William Denzelow reports from the UN in New York.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon accuses both sides in Syria of violating international law. But a group of lawyers say the UN is being overly cautious in its understanding of international humanitarian law. The letter, published in several international newspapers, says consent from the Assad regime is not needed to deliver aid into rebel-controlled areas, despite a UN resolution passed in February calling for unrestricted humanitarian access to Syria. They estimate some 9 million people are being denied aid. The United Nations Security Council is scheduled for further consultations on Syria Wednesday.
And a new poll has given U.S. President Barack Obama an approval rating of only 41%, the lowest mark of his tenure in that particular survey. It's down from the first 3 months of 2014, when Mr. Obama's approval rating was at 46% in the same poll for the Washington Post and ABC News. It's an uncomfortable reading for the Democrats ahead of November's midterm elections. And for the rest of the day's news, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. And that's the latest Feature Story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Mr. Sterling may not attend any NBA games or practices. He may not be present at any Clippers facility, and he may not participate in any business or player personnel decisions involving the team.
Commissioner of the National Basketball Association, Adam Silver, speaking today in response to racist remarks allegedly made by LA Clippers owner Donald Sterling. Not only will 80-year-old Sterling be barred from the NBA, but he'll also face a $2.5 million fine. His fall from grace followed the release of an audio recording over the weekend in which Sterling is purported to tell his girlfriend not to associate publicly with African Americans or bring them to Clippers games. William Gould, a Stanford law professor and expert on labor relations, told me earlier that this case was uncharted territory for the NBA.
It is unprecedented. There have been sanctions imposed upon club owners in sports for misbehavior, misconduct, but never for something like this, generally involving criminal convictions or at least the authority to take action in connection with gambling.
So what legal clout does the NBA have in terms of sanctions, in terms of punishment, in your opinion?
Well, the Constitution and bylaws are the source of authority for the NBA. That is not a public document, although it apparently provides the commissioner with authority to take action in the so-called best interests of basketball. It does lay out sanctions such as fines, apparently up to $1 million, but of course that's chump change for someone of Mr. Sterling's financial means.
So what's the most likely outcome, do you think, going beyond whatever the decision the NBA is today?
I would think that the most likely outcome is some action along the lines of a suspension pending a further investigation into his conduct as a general proposition. One can't be completely certain of this, given the fact that, after all, the commissioner is the employee of the owners. And I don't think, and some of the owners, I believe, are not particularly anxious to take action. But the bottom line is the bottom line. For the NBA, like other sports, and if they see a real threat to that, I think we'll see some kind of action along the lines of a suspension for a limited period of time or an indefinite suspension imposed upon Mr. Sterling.
There have been reports that financial backers for the LA Clippers have now dropped away amid the racism row. This team was bought by Mr. Sterling some time ago for a fairly modest sum. Now it's valued somewhere in the hundreds of millions. Could he just take the money and run?
Oh, he certainly could sell and reap an enormous financial gain. But for Mr. Sterling, I would imagine, like most of the owners, this ownership is of great psychic value. It's like an art painting on the wall, something that he wants to be able to admire and have the public admire him along with it. It may, however, be that given his comments that the there's not going to be too much psychic value for Mr. Sterling in the future.
William Gould, Stanford law professor and expert on labor relations. This is FSN Reports. Can the police search through your cell phone without a warrant during an arrest? That's the question today before the US Supreme Court, who heard two cases that pitch constitutional privacy protections against law enforcement concerns about destruction of evidence. Our Capitol Hill correspondent Alice Olstein reports that some justices, members of Congress and civil liberties experts say the treasure trove of data in modern smartphones shouldn't be up for grabs.
A typical smartphone can hold everything from photos and videos to personal text messages and emails to bank records, medical histories, and a record of the physical location of the owner. For San Diego resident David Leon Riley, it revealed to police that he was affiliated with a gang and committed a shooting 3 weeks before he was pulled over for having an expired license plate. He was sentenced to 15 years to life based just on that evidence, since there were no eyewitnesses to confirm his connection to the shooting.
Somebody's expectation of privacy is reduced upon arrest, but it's not extinguished. It's a question, as the Fourth Amendment says, of what is reasonable.
That's Stanford Law School professor Jeffrey Fisher, the attorney who defended Riley on Tuesday before the U.S. Supreme Court, saying such warrantless searches violate the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution. He acknowledged there could be certain emergency circumstances in which police could perform a warrantless search, to prevent a violent incident, for example, or when there's a serious risk of the evidence on the phone being immediately deleted.
But that's not what these cases are about. These cases are about what happens in every arrest for every crime across the country every day in the United States. Most of those arrests are for misdemeanors and very minor offenses, and it's our position that those kinds of arrests, or even more serious crimes if there's no exigency involved, shouldn't expose somebody's entire life to the police, not just at the scene, but to be downloaded later at the police station and kept in perpetuity.
But lawyers for the state of California and the Obama administration argued Tuesday that police need to be able to search suspects' cell phones and can't wait to get a warrant from a neutral judge. They warned that rapidly developing technology could allow criminals to remotely erase or encrypt the evidence on their phones while police are seeking a warrant. But Fisher told reporters outside the court that this is easily preventable.
Wiping happens by way of a signal that is sent to the phone, so it's very easily defeated. You turn the phone off, you put the phone in airplane mode, or you put it in a special pouch known as a Faraday bag. These are the kind of steps police officers take every day at the scene of the arrest when they gather other evidence and put it in a Ziploc bag and label it and make sure it's not going to be contaminated.
Lawyers for the Obama administration also told the court that because they've held before that police can legally look through the contents of someone's wallet when they arrest him or her, the same principle should apply to cell phones. But some members of Congress disagreed. Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden said he's very troubled the government would make such an argument.
An iPhone, you can basically store everything in somebody's life as opposed to a wallet, which has, you know, smaller number of effects. I'm a privacy guy who thinks that before you get into people's law-abiding records, there ought to be some legal review.
The other case the court heard Tuesday involved a warrantless police search of an older, non-smart flip phone. Despite having no apps or internet connection, police were able to find the suspect's home address and pictures of his girlfriend, and used those to later convict him of dealing drugs. Many constitutional law experts, including Mark Rotenberg with the Electronic Privacy Information Center, wrote briefs to the court urging them to consider that phones will only become more sophisticated over time, so their ruling should offer a broad protection.
You know, lots of people arrested every year in this country. It's over 12 million people. You know, most everybody nowadays is carrying a cell phone, and the concern is that the police will just routinely collect from everybody all the most private information.
Civil liberties advocates are optimistic, considering the court has ruled for privacy and against police searches in two other recent cases concerning tracking suspects with a GPS device and taking blood samples from drunk drivers. A decision on this case is expected this summer. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
The worst I have ever seen, the damning verdict from the vice president of the International Olympic Committee on the state of host city Rio's 2016 preparations. Speaking at an Olympic forum in Sydney, John Coates said the situation on the ground was critical and that it was now too late to move the event to a new location. Spiralling costs and strike action have provided the backdrop to growing public opposition to both the World Cup, now just 43 days away, and the 2016 Olympics. For more on the situation, I spoke to Brazil correspondent for The Economist magazine, Jan Pietrowski.
According to some internal sources, Rio is 10% ready 2 years ahead of the Games, whereas London at this stage was about 60% ready. So it is really critically behind schedule, and it is looking pretty dire.
So only 10% ready. You compared it to London, which is interesting, but of course London already had a lot of the infrastructure in place. Rio didn't, and Brazil is spending an enormous amount of money, and it's fair to say that perhaps a lot of this expenditure for these two events, the World Cup and the Olympics, well, there's plummeting public support for them.
That's right. When Rio won the Games back in 2009, there was overwhelming support for the Games and likewise for the World Cup. Now, support for such events has gone down from about 80% of 4 in 5 Brazilians to fewer than 1 in 2. Only about half of the Brazilian population now support these vast projects. And it really isn't very surprising, because if you look at the... Well, first of all, there are two reasons. One, if you look structurally at big sporting events, they really do not bring the benefits that are often touted for them, either for the economy of the country that is hosting them as a whole, or for the cities in particular. So one study of the Olympics in particular found that since 1960, every single Olympic Games has been over budget. And the average cost overrun was about 180%. Now, it's looking as though Rio, if it were to meet all the current criteria, might be worse still. But perhaps this is an opportunity for Rio and for Brazil to do something that London did back in 1948 and to really present a sort of a forced austerity Games. And that could be a win for the Games, because it might let people focus on the sport rather than the vast and exorbitant expenditure on infrastructure. And indeed for Brazil and for domestic politics, where the Brazilian political class would, by in doing so, actually show the Brazilian people that what it cares about is not necessarily these big white elephant prestige projects, but the good feel that good Games can bring, as it did in London.
What exactly is happening that means they're so behind?
The big problem in Brazil with infrastructure, and not just sporting infrastructure for these big events, is something which is known by the local term Custo Brasil, or the Brazil cost. Doing business in Brazil and actually carrying out infrastructure projects in particular is burdened with a morass of licenses that you need to get, with thickets of red tape. Building infrastructure in Brazil is hard. Building sporting infrastructure is as hard as anything else, but unlike a lot of the other infrastructure, it's unnecessary. And as a result, many people, many Brazilians, are becoming increasingly skeptical of the World Cup and the Olympics. When you speak to ordinary people, for instance, taxi drivers, I make a point of asking taxi drivers whether or not they're in favor of Brazil hosting the World Cup. We all know that Brazil is a football mad country, and yet many of these taxi drivers will tell you that it's a terrible idea, even though they themselves adore football.
Can I just ask you finally, Jan, about this phrase urban renewal, because it was a very important part of the original pitch from Brazil to the IOC and to FIFA. We were going to transform these sprawling, impoverished urban areas. Has that at least been a success?
Not really, so far as I can tell. There have been very ambitious plans to use the World Cup and the Olympics to basically to prompt regeneration in some of the favelas, the shanty towns, which surround many big Brazilian cities, and in particular Rio de Janeiro. But this too has been well behind schedule. Some people in the favelas feel that they, in fact, have been expropriated, and in fact, many of the favela dwellers have themselves taken to protesting against the sporting events because they feel that they're being disenfranchised.
Brazil correspondent for The Economist, Jan Pietrowski. And finally tonight, FSN Spotlight, our new segment taking an in-depth look at a story you might have missed. With today's edition, Simon Marks.
On FSN Spotlight today, the man who wants to be Britain's next Prime Minister and the American political consultant he's hired to help him.
Surely we can do better than this as a country. And I think people are hurting. People are wanting us to do better. People are thinking, look, you know, I've made the sacrifices. Well, where's the benefit? The government keeps telling me that everything's fixed. It doesn't seem fixed for me. And they need a government. They need a Prime Minister. And that's the Prime Minister I'll be, who will actually wake up each morning and think, how do we make life easier for ordinary families? Never mind the obstacles. Never mind the powerful interests that are in the way. We're willing to take them on. We're willing to act to help ordinary families. You're never going to get that from David Cameron.
That's Ed Miliband, the leader of Britain's opposition Labour Party, speaking there in a New Year's message to the nation back in January. It's been nearly 4 years since he took the helm of the Labour Party, and his big, perhaps his only chance to become Britain's Prime Minister is now just 12 months away. The country's next general election will be held on May the 7th, 2015. Even Mr. Miliband's most fervent supporters acknowledge that he suffers from a charisma deficit. He's an uneven performer in the British Parliament and has struggled to project the image of leadership required to win the keys of No. 10 Downing Street. So now Mr. Miliband has called in the cavalry.
Hi, I'm David Axelrod, and I'm proud to join the Labour team.
David Axelrod arrived in Britain a week ago, his entry to the British political scene attracting a blaze of publicity and a blaze of questions about whether Barack Obama's image maker can work similar magic for Ed Miliband. He got straight to work, extolling the virtues of his new employer in an official Labour Party video.
Ed Miliband understands that a healthy economy is one where hardworking people are rewarded for their work, where you can stay ahead of those cost of living pressures, where you can plan for your futures and hope for your children. And Ed understands that government has to spend responsibly, cut where it can, but also make smart investments to assure broad prosperity in the future.
So how's it all going down in Britain? It's a mixed bag, according to three contributors to Britain's Guardian newspaper. Columnist Martin Kettle, political diarist Hugh Muir, and Max Wind-Cowie, an associate with the Demos think tank. In this excerpt from the Guardian's Politics Weekly podcast, they talked to host Tom Clark. And Martin Kettle, a former Washington correspondent for the paper, kicks things off.
I think really this reflects the fact that it's very difficult to win a general election and it's worth investing quite a lot of money if you're a political party in trying to do so in current circumstances. So, I mean, I don't think Axelrod is somebody who, and as you say, sprinkle magic dust or whatever over it. I think he's somebody who's very good at maximising the returns at the margins. You know, what he did more than anything else was to pursue a multifaceted strategy to get the vote out by appealing to a significant set of demographics in the American electorate on behalf of Obama. Now, I mean, you know, Ed Miliband is not Barack Obama in either the good sense or the bad sense, I think. He's just very different kind of marketing proposition. And I don't think it means that, you know, Axelrod's going to kind of bring loads and loads of razzmatazz. I think he's just, I think he's a hardworking political consultant, and that's how he should be seen. I think that's basically how he should see it. Can I just say, I think it's pathetic, though, that the British political class is so in hock to American political consultancy that these things are necessary. All this could be done domestically.
All those poor British Labour Party staffers left out of work because of David Axelrod. I absolutely agree with that.
On your side there's Lyndon Crosby and Jim Messina, another Obama man who's working for Cameron now, isn't he?
There is almost nobody in Westminster who doesn't want to be in the West Wing, and that's a very embarrassing and faintly kind of gauche truism. But what I think is underlyingly true about all of this, though, is, I mean, it's kind of complete nonsense to imagine that the job that David Axelrod had of selling Barack Obama to the American people resembles in any way, shape or form the job that the Labour Party has of selling Ed Miliband. And that's not because, just because Ed Miliband lacks certain things like, you know, the charisma and the backstory, etc., of Barack Obama. It's also because fundamentally, the way in which British elections work, the way in which British voters will vote, it just works on a different mechanism to in the US. And I was talking to somebody who does lots and lots of polling the other day, and he was explaining that, you know, actually we all are obsessed with this idea of kind of pitting David Cameron against Ed Miliband and this kind of increasingly presidential notion of politics, because that's more fun for us as political writers or as people who work in politics. But that genuinely is not how the British electorate votes. And actually, according to this chap who has the numbers, it is far, far better in British elections to enter those elections being behind your party in terms of your personal polling being behind how popular your party is, than it is to enter elections as David Cameron will, being much, much more popular than your party. Because somewhere deep down, the British electorate remember that we are a parliamentary democracy and not a presidential
system. That's going to be a matter of degree, though, isn't it? And it's how much you're lagging behind your party and whether or not you're actually a millstone on your party. And I suspect that if there's an advantage to having Axelrod, then it's someone who is used to dealing with personality elections, and he might be able to finally figure out that Miliband, in terms of personality, how you pitch him. You clearly can't pitch him like you would an American candidate, because he's not that strong a personality. But I'm sure that this won't be the first time Axelrod had a candidate where you think, well, there are huge flaws here. We have to work our way through the flaws. But at least he will have some understanding of the importance of the personality issue.
What does it say about players on the one hand versus managers, backroom people on the other? I mean, it seems to me that we're putting an awful lot of faith in back office staff to be able to come in and move political players around to do different things.
I guess that's true. I mean, you know, you do have to say that in the end, what a party stands for is the thing that people recognise, just as the anonymous poll expert was saying to Max. And I think that is right. The presidentialism can be exaggerated, but it's important. I think it was unquestionably quite important in 1992 that Neil Kinnock suddenly felt in the spotlight like somebody who people were unhappy with the prospect that this man might be prime minister, and so you know they even preferred John Major, who was not, after all, the most charismatic figure in British political history, to that. I just think in this country, political campaigning is, on the whole, extraordinarily amateur still compared with what happens not just in America but in many other countries.
Martin Kettle of The Guardian, alongside his colleague Hugh Muir, and Max Wind-Cowie of the think tank Demos. They were talking to Tom Clark about David Axelrod now attempting to conquer British politics. You can find Politics Weekly and a host of other podcasts from The Guardian on the newspaper's website at theguardian.com. With FSN Spotlight, I'm Simon Marks.
And that's the Tuesday edition of FSN Reports. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us reports@featurestory.com and follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Wednesday, we investigate why so many innocent people are facing death row in the United States. That's Wednesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the bulletin desk. For everyone, with Feature Story news everywhere. Have a great evening. Goodbye.